My guest at this time is Cleta Mitchell. She's a partner in the Washington, D.C. law firm of Foley & Lardner. She represents several high-profile clients. For example, we have spoken with her many times about clients who allege they were harassed by the IRS when applying for nonprofit status. She joins us today, though, to discuss her recent column in the New York Times that blasts the current women's movement for refusing to declare victory on many of the issues they started fighting for decades ago, and for becoming, in her view, a monolithic left-wing movement that tolerates little or no dissent on key issues, particularly abortion. And Cleta, thanks very much for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me, Greg.
Well, as you point out at the very beginning of the piece in the New York Times, you were very active in the women's movement pretty much at its inception. You were at the University of Oklahoma in the early 70s. You were a state lawmaker there for a time. So this has happened right as your adulthood began and your career began. How different is today's women's movement, as it's defined, than the one you were actively part of in the 70s and more recently?
Well, I can tell you that I was involved for a number of years before the issue of abortion even arose, notwithstanding the fact that Roe v. Wade was decided in the early 70s. But that isn't what caused the That wasn't the genesis of the women's movement. It was really to identify laws that treated women and men differently. Our law evolved from the English common law, and women, anyone who's ever read Pride and Prejudice knows that the key issue in the book is the English common law, which didn't allow the daughters to inherit from their father. So they had to find a husband for their daughters in order that the property would go to their daughters through their husbands rather than a cousin. And so that is something with which people are familiar. And we had many laws that developed in the United States over a period of centuries that treated women differently. Women weren't allowed to serve on juries. They weren't allowed into professions. They weren't, in the 19th century, they weren't allowed to speak in public and serve on juries. And so there just was a lot of discrimination in the laws. And that's what I and my counterparts in Oklahoma were working toward. Fortunately, we were successful. Those laws were eradicated. There is no disparate treatment of women under the law in the United States today, period. It does not exist. It is not allowed. And the women's movement refuses to declare victory, mainly because it has morphed into a giant lobby for abortion. And it's not within the construct of Roe versus Wade. It is abortion on demand with no restrictions. And essentially, the feminists are the ones who fight licensing and other rules and regulations to ensure the safety of women, because they say it restricts their choice, which means that it doesn't allow for abortion on demand. So to me, it's all changed from what it started out to be when I was involved 40 years ago.
We're talking with Cleta Mitchell, partner at the Washington law firm of Foley & Lardner, and her piece on the state of the women's movement and why they won't declare victory is in the March 31st edition of the New York Times. Cleta, by anyone's standard, whether it's in the 70s or today, you are an example of a successful American professional woman. You've risen in the ranks of the law. You have high-profile clients. You're very successful. But you don't necessarily subscribe to the same political beliefs as the modern women's movement. So how are you received or others received that you know of who don't subscribe to that orthodoxy?
Well, as I write in the piece, I think that conservative professional women are virtually invisible within the ranks of what would be the women's movement. If you are a pro-life conservative professional woman, you're really a pariah. Within the ranks of whether it's the Women's Bar Association or any of these women's organizations, I can promise you that women are simply who have views that are pro-life and who are conservative are not welcome. I'll give you an example. A few years ago, my law firm sponsored part of a seminar. We were one of the corporate sponsors of a group of women presidents of businesses. and it was a national meeting in Chicago. And so some of the top women in our firm were asked to go and represent our firm at this meeting, which I did. And I was on the bus going to dinner. They had us go to different small dinners around the city of Chicago. We were assigned to go with different women. And so these women started asking what I do. And I said that I was a lawyer, and they thought that was interesting, political law. And when they found out who my clients were, one of them looked at me, and this was a number of years ago, and said, "Well, does that mean that you know Tom DeLay?" I said, "Yes, I know Tom DeLay." And he was a House Majority Leader at the time, and they said, "Well, you can't be friends with him." I said, "Well, as a matter of fact, I am friends with him, and I think he's a fine legislator, and I help him every chance I can." And these women just looked at me, and they just instantly just turned away. You know, they said, because then one of them said, "Well, what are your views on abortion?" I said, "Well, I'm pro-life." And they said, "How can you be pro-life and pro-woman?" I mean, these women just pounced on me. And I just, you know, I thought, you know, I'm just not even going to try to go to any of these women business things, because there are just so many women within that. They tend to be the older women, but still, you know, they're the ones who organize this march. And there's no daylight if you are a pro-life, conservative professional woman. You are not welcome in the ranks of the women who put together networks and events and all to promote themselves.
Is it the radical elements of the party? Is it the media? What is responsible for this more rigid approach than what you experienced 40 years ago?
Well, I really watched it begin to happen. The truth of the matter is, Phyllis Schlafly was right. In the final analysis, Phyllis was absolutely right. And I was glad I was able to tell her that many, many times before she died last year. She said that it wasn't possible to have the Equal Rights Amendment and a quote, women's movement without it morphing into something that we didn't want to have happen. And I didn't believe that as a 20-something-year-old, but I came to realize that she was right. And I began to see that happening toward the end of the time when I was active in the women's movement, where I began to see that it was morphing at that time into the abortion issue, that we were also being confronted with things like gay rights. And I didn't have any interest in those things because I thought that wasn't what represented most of American women and the challenges that women face. And but I think that the fact is that Phyllis was right, that it was the natural progression, that it would be taken over by the left wing, which it was. And so, of course, you have Hollywood starlets, you have Madonna, Ashley Judd, Angela Davis, for Pete's sake. She's a communist and a vowed communist. And those are the speakers at the Women's March. Do you see the media making any big deal out of the fact that Angela Davis was one of the speakers?
I'm guessing you don't have a pink woolen hat, Cleta.
I do not have one of those. And in fact, it's funny, one of my friends told me that she was on this. She's a conservative, active Republican lawyer, and she was wearing a pink scarf on the subway the day of the march, and she kept getting all these people smiling at her. She didn't know why.
Speaking of the Women's March, Cleta, here in our last minute or two, one of the things that baffled a lot of people is not only the rigid stance, and we saw activists saying that pro-life women were not welcome at the Women's March because to be pro-woman is to be pro-choice, as you explained earlier. That's how the movement kind of evolved over the years. But at the same time, it was co-sponsored and very supportive of Islam, which, of course, in many different countries and in many different cases, affords far fewer rights to women than America did even 40 years ago.
Well, there is no doubt about that. And that's the ultimate irony. I mean, in all honesty, it was an anti-Trump march. These were women who were upset that Hillary didn't win. They were left-wing Democrats. This was sponsored by and paid for. I kept saying, who's paying for this? Because these things aren't cheap. But how in the world the women's movement could not be demanding that Islamic leaders change their views toward women? I mean, how we are supposed to turn our back on the mistreatment of women in the Muslim, under the Muslim religion in the Muslim countries? I just don't get it. And it only shows to me that this is, that there was no point. It was a pointless, purposeless march other than a giant venting by people who were angry that Hillary Clinton didn't win, but and who are angry at Trump. But here's the thing that I don't, here's one of the things I had to cut because of space. But I would like to write a whole piece about how these people could be so outraged about Donald Trump's comments when I don't remember any of those women coming out of the woodwork and having marches around the world when Bill Clinton was guilty of being a sexual predator while he was president. So I think the double standard is enormous. But because Bill Clinton was pro-abortion and Hillary Clinton was pro-abortion, then they could not, of course, they would never, they kept their mouths shut about him.
Last question before we let you go. Given the fact that the women's movement is now so clearly ensconced in the left wing of American politics, do you think that its voice ultimately gets tuned out? There's a lot of liberal women who are upset about the number of women who did vote for Donald Trump. So do you think most of the American people see it as a liberal entity and see it that way rather than whether it's Hillary Clinton or one of these other surrogates talking about how they are the voice of women?
Well, I think that a lot of women do just tune them out, and they think, you know, and I mean, who would you, I don't think that today you could even identify and say off the top of your head who's the most important spokesperson or spokeswoman for women, the women's movement in America. There was a time when you had some women who would immediately come to mind. Today, that is really Cecile Richards, the head of Planned Parenthood, and that's who they look to as a key leader, as well as Angela Davis. And the, you know, they bring Gloria Steinem out of mothballs. And but in the final analysis, they're all talking about abortion and abortion rights. I don't think that's where the majority of American women are. The country is becoming more and more pro-life, as science demonstrates that life begins at conception. And I think that what we're seeing is that people, women and men, are just tuning them out. Other than, you know, every organization, firm, company, et cetera, has to have a women's network, and men are made to feel as though they have to walk on eggshells for fear of saying something inappropriate. You know, and I do think that men need to be careful about saying things that are inappropriate, but I also know that some of these women's advancement programs are a little silly.
Well, Cleta, as you mentioned, there might be another piece in the works, and we'll be keeping an eye out for that. Thank you very much for this column and for joining us today to talk about it.
Thank you so much, Greg. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. Cleta Mitchell, partner in the Washington law firm of Foley Lardner. Her article entitled No Room for Dissent in Today's No Room for Dissent in Women's Movement Today appeared in the March 31st edition of the New York Times. I'm Greg Corumbus, reporting for Radio America.